And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to be talking about Beggar Thy Neighbor economic development schemes. They're proving to be very lucrative. A lot of money involved, but it may not be who you may be led to believe is benefiting it. You and me, not so much. Also going to talk about the North Dakota banking situation, because North Dakota is viewed as an amazing banking success story. And if it works so well in North Dakota, shouldn't Pennsylvania look at what they're doing right? Maybe think about best practices. Think about doing that here. We'll talk about the banking scheme there in North Dakota. Also, some good news on the Affordable Care Act coming out. How's Pennsylvania doing? And who's standing in the way? No real surprises. No real surprises here. We know who's standing in the way. The Koch brothers, the billionaires, the Corbetts, the Flacks who kowtow for the very well-to-do. Also, the attacks on workers continue as the General Assembly goes after workers' compensation, local autonomy, and a bunch of heavily funded attacks on regulations. And also, finally, we'll also talk about Selfiegate. Yes, the president took a picture of himself. Is it the end of civilization? Also, don't forget the handshake, the dreaded handshake. Oh, you know, because we've got nothing else to worry about, right? Nothing at all. I'm also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me during the program at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Another day of rage in the Smith household, and just kind of got to get it off my chest. This, as you know, I'm not somebody who believes heavily in the idea of a public-private partnership. There are things that the private sector should be doing for the benefit of shareholders, for the benefit of the owners of the companies, and also for the workers, and for society as a whole. I mean, but that's far down the list these days. And then there's the public side of it that should be for the benefit of the public, for we the people, a government of, for, and by we the people. I don't know that there are a lot of things that you should be meshing. Roads and bridges, for instance, not thrilled with the idea of having the public-private partnership, because what ends up happening? Well, you and I end up paying through the nose. Because not only are you paying for the public good, you're paying for the profit to go with it, where we could have just done it for ourselves. I mean, you look at all of these schemes in Chicago, the parking authorities and the turnpike, and Indiana, the same thing. In Harrisburg, eventually going to be the parking authority, and all of this stuff doesn't really benefit us all that much. So today, you know, I got caught up in one of these really weird public-private partnership schemes. And, you know, I haven't talked about this at all because, you know, I've just been furious about it. And I had to fight it. You know, I ended up in court today. Evidently my tax attorney filed one local tax form. And I gotta, you know, if there is anyone else out in the listening audience who this has happened to, I would love to hear from you. Because I sat in a room full of really angry people who were in the same boat that I was. And as we sat there, I was there like 2.5 hours. And you did the math, the real quick math, which was in the time I was there, they collected about $1,200 an hour in court costs and fines, because everyone got hit with basically the same fine, $101.50, and it was amicable. I love that one. I want to appreciate that sentiment when the judge told me we can come to an amicable resolution here. We could both agree. And I'm going, yeah, much like a guy with a gun to his head, you can come to an amicable agreement. Don't shoot me and I'll give you whatever you want. That seems fairly amicable in their world. I won't go into what else I said. Probably not suitable for radio. But and all of these people who are being extorted, in my view, in the same way, because of this public-private partnership. Now, let me go back. 2011, my tax attorney files one local tax form. Files a local, a state, and a federal. As I have done every year of my life, one local, one state, one federal. Pretty simple. Doesn't get much more complicated than that. Then your local municipality goes, okay, well, here's the money for the school district, here's the money for the cops and the firefighters, and the money for the trash. One place did it. Except where I live, where the local township goes, well, we want our private company to do it. And the school district said, no, we're going to have our private company do it. And they each had their private companies, unbeknownst to a large number of taxpayers like me, whose tax attorney, you expect them to file all the forms. And look, he's going to pay all the fines and all that stuff. It just seems to me that it was wrong that this system was set up. And I guess it was the first time that I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, but it was kind of the first time that I realized that when I pay my taxes to my township, when I pay my school taxes, I'm not paying it directly to the township. I'm not paying it directly to the school district. I'm paying it to a private corporation. And this corporation is then deciding whether what they're going to do with it. And, you know, as I was sitting talking to the group of angry people, because there were quite a number of folks not happy, they started off with this anti-government sentiment. Well, you know, it's the government, it's there. I go, well, you know, I'll agree with you on it. It's bad governance in a heavily Republican area. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But to me, I had to ask the question of how much of this is patronage? You know, where everywhere I ever lived, you had the local government collected their taxes. You set your form in, they did it. Here, you've got local municipalities and school districts saying, well, we're going to pick our guy. No, we're going to pick our guy. And you got to start wondering, is there some patronage? Was there some kickback going on there? How is it that these two entities couldn't come to a decision and say, we're going to use the same people? We'll use the same private company. And I'm sure they'd give you a little kickback, too, if you asked. That's probably unfair. But I look at this, and you know, and by the end of the stint in the closed quarters, most of the people in the room are going, yeah, privatization, this is a bad idea. And I looked at it, and I go, you know, these are the kind of conversations we need to be having on a whole number of issues. Because, you know, I'm somebody who looks for this stuff. And I didn't realize that my local school taxes are collected by a private company. They're not collected by the school district or my local municipality, which just blows my mind. And then I brought up the question, why the hell do we elect a tax collector if a private company is doing this? So it left me with a lot of questions. Now, I went into the court hearing today knowing there was no way in a snowball's chance I was going to win. Because you never really do. But it comes back to me to something pretty simple. As we were sitting in the room talking, I said, you know, how many people voted for the people who made these decisions? You know, in off-year elections, you get about 13. The one off-year election, you had like 13% of the voters come out to vote. So you got a small number of people who have voted these folks who affect your everyday life. Such a small number of people affecting pretty much every day of your life. Much more. I mean, your local tax collector, local county commissioner, and your county supervisor, or any of those people affect your life much more than the president or Congress. And it's little things like this. Now, should my accountant, should he have known that this municipality and this school district, they didn't have one form? Should he have known that? Probably, I think. I would hope. He knows now. But it still didn't stop me from having to be pulled into court and plead the case of I pay my taxes like anybody else. And I guess my concern in this was pretty simply that, you know, I do this job for a living where I say, you know, you pay your taxes, you do what you to fund, you know, all of our roads, our bridges, education, all of that stuff. And then to have a situation that could have the appearance that I didn't pay my taxes bothered me. And the first question I asked to the woman from the private company who acted as the prosecutor, which I loved. I mean, I loved the whole dynamic. because you walked in there and you knew you're not winning. And of the stream of people who, like me, thought you'd have a shot of pleading your case and getting some, throwing yourself on the mercy of the court, everyone came out with the same basic amicable. And I love that. I just love the word amicable. Oh, it's amicable. You know, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do and you're going to like it. Very amicable. Which is why I go back to 13% of the population in this local area bothered to vote in the off-year election. And it's just not in my local area. It's really across the country. And I guess it's not surprising that you end up with these anti-government sentiments, because everybody sitting in the room were pointing their finger at the government saying, see, this is why we need to get rid of government. And I'm going, but I'm sorry, they used the instrument of a private corporation. Had it been your local government office, had it been your township handling their own tax situation, had it been the school district handling their own, you wouldn't have had this. And maybe had you had a General Assembly who now, after the fact, has fixed it and said you can't have two anymore, but had you taken care of this back then, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But every time these things do happen, what you end up with is you end up with people like me who end up in those situations blaming the government. And I don't. I blame the voter. Because this should have never happened. And this, again, goes back to that failure of two entities to go, you know what? Good governance. Represent the people. Just my thought. But again, if there's anybody out there who's been in that situation, have been pulled in, I would love to hear from you. I got so many great stories from people that, you know, I'm still trying to figure out if I'm going to rant about this for some time, because, you know, I do feel extorted a bit. But, you know, we'll see in the coming days, weeks, and months, especially with the holiday season coming up. You know, getting hit with the $101.50 from the court and then the $80 from the private corporation, just kind of a slap in the face, especially when your taxes were paid. That's what bothers me. If I was trying to scheme the system, if I was trying to go, I'm not going to pay, I'm deliberately going to, I could see it then, but not so much now. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back and talk about the beggar thy neighbor economic development schemes in New York and across the country, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're not against trade in the Steelworkers Union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The Steelworkers Union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their head in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track Authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop that from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this pact on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade in natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The goal really is to incentivize companies to come here in Pennsylvania, but not put it under pressure of the taxpayers. The companies have to make the investment. The companies have to hire somebody, or they get nothing. Not one red cent gets laid out by the Commonwealth, as it has in past programs. We think this is innovative and different than what other states are doing.
Different. The innovative and different part, the state tax that you think you're paying to the state government, just gets to be kept by the company. That's innovative and different. Gotta love that. Representative Benninghoff, yeah, well, hey, you know, one scheme after another. And I look at this report by David K. Johnston, who points out that this year New York State will give away a total of $1.7 billion under the guise of job creation. That's the state government subsidies to corporations, partnerships, other businesses throughout the state of New York. That number is triple the amount that was given away in 2005. According to David K. Johnston, $235 from the average Empire State household is what we're talking about. And that $235 is redistributed to the business because we're business friendly. We're going to give it out because they're, you know, if we just redistribute wealth from us, the workers, to the companies, they'll hire us, right? Give them money, they will. That seems to be the mantra we're told. But sadly, the facts, whole different story. And according to Johnston, the state of New York's official job data website points out that the number of jobs in New York has declined. In fact, they've lost about 175,000 jobs since 2005. And as he points out, think of it this way. They lost each household about $1,400, 175,000 jobs, about $57,000 per job lost, where we were told, hey, it's going to benefit us. So here are some new numbers are going to be coming out soon. Some new corporate tax breaks are going to be going out in, from the New York Regional Economic Development Council and groups like Align, the Alliance for a Greater New York, and Getting Our Money's Worth. This coalition released a new report examining how New York's economic development programs perform in the region and whether they're actually creating jobs. And here to talk about that is Thomas Gardunio. He's the political director for the Alliance for a Greater New York. Tomas, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So I look at these numbers that, David K. Johnson's thrown out. $1.7 billion this year, he claims, under the guise of job creation, and yet you've actually lost jobs. How does that square with what we're told, that if we give them money, they'll create jobs?
Well, I mean, I think the numbers speak for themselves. I mean, you know, this economic model is not working, Rick. I mean, I think we've been trying it over and over and over again. You know, they say the definition of being insane is if you try the same thing over and over again expecting a different result. Well, we've been playing this economic game since the 80s with Reagan and trickle-down economics, and we're still waiting for it to trickle down.
And, you know, I look at all of these things, and what ends up, where I grew up in Cleveland, we had a mayor who ended up being governor, and then Senator George Voinovich, who basically gave the baby and the bathwater away. And the city's infrastructure crumbled. The schools crumbled, ended up moving to charter schools. It seemed to me that by giving all of the resource to these companies, what you were doing is starving your city, starving your citizens, starving your local communities.
That's exactly right. You know, we've actually found that in our research, there's actually $7 billion worth of subsidies that go out every year. Those are taxpayer dollars that either we're losing through particular economic development programs, or we're never even seeing the money because of tax abatements and other such schemes. And, you know, we're saying that we need some serious reform, and we need it now.
So, you know, because I've had some recent input from folks saying, well, we've got to figure out how to create jobs. And what we're being spoon-fed is that this is the way we create jobs, with big checks. Companies will only come to the area if you give them huge tax abatements and huge subsidies and all kind of welfare. But as these reports like yours and others point out, even welfare is not creating jobs.
That's right. And, you know, the other thing about most of these tax subsidies is that they're going to huge corporations. They're not going to your local mom-and-pop shops or your local businesses that could actually use the money and, you know, would most likely hire folks and pay them well. For example, Target Corporation is currently receiving 14 separate subsidies across New York.
Wow.
Their retail stores and warehouses. That only takes into account the 7 programs that actually have regional data that we can access. The problem is that most of this happens without any particular promises of actual job fees.
And no clawback either.
That's correct. There are some local industrial development agencies that actually do have clawback measures, but they're uncoordinated and they're the super minority of the overall subsidy program in the state. And we have actually been working with Assemblyman Ryan on the state level to introduce the Jobs Act, which is the Just and Open Business Subsidies Act, which would actually create one system across the state so that we could actually track this information and find out whether or not these programs are working. Now, of course, the big corporations don't want that.
See, that's the thing that blows my mind, Tomas, is that we give out all this money. And I don't think there's anyone that you'll talk to who's against job creation. I don't think there's anyone you'll talk to who says, I'm against helping business grow and employ people at decent wages for the good of the community. I don't think you're going to find anybody who's against that. But I think, from my perspective, I'm against handing big boatloads of money without any accountability. And what you've laid out is, doesn't sound like there's any accountability or really any strategy.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, every single one of these different programs don't necessarily speak to each other. And so that's what allows these massive corporations like Target and Walmart or others to be able to basically cherry pick from all throughout the state. And then, you know, also essentially hold our communities hostage by saying, well, if you don't give us the money, we'll go to another, you know, city or county. And then it's just a race to the bottom.
Let me ask you this, you know, because, you know, I came across, as I was looking this up today a little bit, I came across some interesting statistics of how out of hand this has gotten. Because I think most people think, well, today is how it's always been. I mean, this is just, it's business as usual. And the reality is these kind of subsidies haven't always been the way business has been done in this country. We haven't always said, oh, please come to my area, and if you come here, we'll give you big checks and free stuff. Or in your experience, has it always been that way?
Oh, no, not at all. You're absolutely right, Rick. I mean, this is a relatively recent phenomenon that's definitely happened within my lifetime. I mean, the sort of idea of hard work and business ethics that I think definitely were more a sign of my parents' generation, you know, just seems to have gone to the wayside. Now, that's, of course, only true with these huge corporations whose sole interest is their bottom line and making profit. I mean, the other thing I think it's important to mention is that these, you know, most of these subsidies are only being accessed by about 4% of businesses New York's case. So that means that 96% of businesses throughout the state are actually shouldering the tax burden of that 4%. And, you know, in most cases, like I said, they're not local small businesses that are accessing these subsidies because of all the different forms and different regulations that exist, because there isn't one streamlined process. That's why we think the Jobs Act would actually really improve this thing and hopefully access, you know, help small businesses access some of the support that could actually create, you know, good local jobs that are good paying jobs, because we know that these big box stores, the few jobs they might actually create are poverty wage jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, but in looking at this, I guess I got to ask the question, are we against the idea of handing money to these companies? Are we against, because I got to be honest, I think it's a fool's errand to say we're going to give money. I mean, I'm okay with helping with location. I'm okay with you know, infrastructure, education. I'm okay with that. I'm leery, and I think it's really a fool's errand to go, here's a big check. I struggle with that. So I guess my question is are we against the idea of giving these companies money?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely understand what you're saying, Rick. I mean, I think at this point the jury's still out, and that's part of why we want better information and, you know, better coordinated programs, is because the sort of conventional wisdom is that that's, like you said, the only way to go about it. Well,
Is it conventional wisdom that it's actual conventional wisdom, or is it what we're being spoon-fed by the 4% of companies who are benefiting the most from those subsidies?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's become conventional wisdom because it's, you know, been talking point after talking point for literally decades about, you know, way that economic development happens. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm definitely not convinced by any means that subsidies are the only way to create a strong economy. And so, you know, we want to find that answer out by asking this information. I don't think that we're necessarily against all different types of economic development programs, but we want to be able to look at the data and say across the board, where is it working? Where are they creating good, local, sustainable jobs that are well-paying jobs, and which are not? And let's be smart about it. Let's say, okay, well, let's accentuate and support what's working. Or if the data shows that none of it's working, let's think of a new approach.
Yeah, I'm with you. And to highlight, you know, David K. Johnson, in one of his articles not too long ago, in talking about the New York situation, he used $1.7 billion. You've said it's considerably higher than that. Which I don't doubt. I mean, his numbers are generally very conservative. He pointed out that, adjusted for inflation, the New York State business giveaway programs are 9 times larger in 2013 than they were in 1994. And he said the cost of those giveaway programs to businesses in current dollars rose from $200 million in 1994 to $673 million in 2005, $821 million in 2009, and then his number of $1.7 billion this year. And I don't doubt $7 billion. So you see that just over the years, we've become accustomed to going, here, please, take our money. And in this case, 175,000 jobs light.
That's right. Yeah, and, you know, I think the discrepancy in numbers is mostly because the $7 billion that we came to includes, for example, property tax abatements and other types of what we consider subsidies, which
right.
actually are money that never actually went into the coffers in the first place, but ought to have. But yes, I mean, we're seeing the same trend in our research, is that it's increasing year and year, and particularly in New York. I mean, it's interesting because our neighbor, New Jersey, only gives out about $50 million a year in tax subsidies, which is a, you know, drop in the bucket and compared to the now. Of course, the size of the economies are significantly different, but still, I think it goes to show that there's actually a fair amount of different states around the country that have approached this issue in a much, well, let's just be straight about it, sane way.
Right.
And, you know, they don't have the sort of Bloomberg approach to, the city or the state is open for business.
Because it seems to me that what we end up with in this, and it's odd to me that we have this kind of this national competition where states literally bloody themselves before we, because you know we live in a global economy, and it blows my mind that you seeing states they're beating each other bloody before we even get into the international arena where we're already bloodied and beaten because we've given away or at least the taxpayers have given away their base before we get into the international community. So a lot of me says, you know, it's not surprising these corporations, you know, they're global. They don't care about this country. They'll wave the flag when it's good to put on TV, but it's all about the bottom line. It's the cash they put in their pockets.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, I think you can see that fact in that, you know, they're not interested in actually showing us the jobs. Right? I mean, if these programs were working, I'm sure that they would be the first ones to say, look at all the jobs that we created. We found that, you know, in our report, nearly $2.3 billion of that $7 billion a year is wasted, meaning that either there was no jobs promised, there was no job creation, or there was an actual loss of jobs. So we're basically giving away $2.3 billion a year for nothing. And the rest of it, the other nearly two-thirds of that money, might create some jobs, but we don't know how many. And for, you know, nearly $5 billion worth of tax breaks, it should be creating hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, and it's just it's mind blowing to me. So let me ask you this: we've identified that there's a problem, and I think on a visceral level, I think the American people know that it's just not good. It's not good sense. It's not good business. It's not smart. It's not sane. It's not logical to go here's a bunch of money, because I think we all know business corporations are not in business to create jobs. They're in business to make money. I think we all understand that. So what's the marching order? What's the alternative? What are we telling people? Because it's one thing to complain and go, oh, they're stealing from us. But what's the direction? What are we advocating for?
Well, here on the state level in New York, like I mentioned earlier, we're working with some of our state legislators to try to pass the Jobs Act, which would, at the very least, create some, you know, lend some sunshine to these programs so that we would have a certain level of transparency and accountability, which would actually create some clawback measures so that if these programs, the corporations that access these programs don't create the kind of jobs that they promised they'll create, that we actually get our money back. And so we think that that's definitely some common sense reform. It really is actually quite bipartisan. I mean, you know, I don't think that anybody wants a bad deal when it comes to giving money, you know, giving our taxpayer dollars away, regardless of what aisle you sit on. So we're, you know, working really hard to pass that in the upcoming legislative session in 2014. And I think, you know, there's plenty of other partners that we've been talking with around the country that are looking at economic development subsidy reform similar to this. And, you know, I think that it's ultimately a first step in a longer, more, you know, multi-year process of actually asking the question, with good data, do these programs even work, and should we look at a different way to do economic development?
Yeah, I'm with you. We've got an awful lot to work, a lot of work to do. I appreciate you taking time for it. Fill us again on what's going on in New York, because, you know, we're going through the same things here in Pennsylvania. To me, this is, it's not just one area that's going through this. It's all across the country, and it's something that we've got to be talking all across the country about and how we fix this. Thomas Gardenio, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. My pleasure.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Should we be handing out huge checks? Is that the right way? Back after this.
Would you dive 14 feet deep into Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
A quote, message of the week is handed out. Talking points, including lines of attack, are distributed. Social media tactics are taught. New messaging tools like digital flyers are deployed. Opinion articles are pre-written, and a 17-page playbook lays out the strategy. All this and much more is part of an all-out centralized military-style assault that House Republicans are making in a desperate attempt to kill Obamacare, with their larger mission being to crush the idea that every American deserves good quality health care. The campaign is being directed through Speaker John Boehner's office, with all 231 GOP members expected to take marching orders, penetrate every media market, and stir up as much negative noise as possible to sabotage Obama's Affordable Care Act. Most members of this anti-care brigade, however, seem blissfully unaware of an explosive irony in their furious assault on Obamacare. It was their idea. While Democrats long advocated that universal health care should be achieved by simply extending Medicare to everyone, Republicans always countered that coverage should be run through the insurance corporations with a requirement that younger and healthier people buy into it. Richard Nixon proposed this concept in 1974. Then, in 1989, the Heritage Foundation, a Republican allied think tank, basically proposed the full privatized system embodied in the ACA, including the individual mandate that everyone buy an insurance policy. Such far-right-wing GOP Congress critters as Senator Orrin Hatch and Newt Gingrich became leading champions of this scheme, the very one that they and fellow Republicans are now trying to demonize and slay. This is Jim Hightower saying, the deeper irony is that should the GOP succeed, Democrats can then return to the more sensible plan of Medicaid for all.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor. And I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So what do you think? I mean, do we give out more of these huge subsidies? Is this how we create jobs in the 21st century? Because, and I go back to, you know, to a quote I heard years ago, to where if you give, a guy said, if you give me a tax cut, I'm going to go on vacation. You give me demand, you put money in consumers' pockets and put someone walking in my door saying, I want to buy your product, then I'll hire someone. This idea that here's a handout, go create jobs, is ludicrous on so many levels. And, you know, you look at study after study, because we've been spoon-fed this. And, you know, I brought it out there that, you know, in 94 you're talking about $200 million they gave in economic development. Hey, you know, go do something. And it has just grown exponentially year after year after year. And you've got states who are squealing, saying, please, stop. I look at Missouri, where the governor in Missouri is begging the Kansas governor, please stop this. Stop this border war that's going on, where we've got companies moving across the city of Kansas City taking huge amounts of money of taxpayer dollars that should be going into education and infrastructure and all kinds of things, but just going to pad the bottom lines of companies like AMC, you know, the people who own the movie theaters. And, you know, I look back at this, and I got to be honest, you know, you think back to when my grandparents roamed the earth during their working years, this kind of stuff would have never happened during their era. And I got to think that it was part of our media culture. What we've got is a repetitive media. They're just stenographers. and regurgitators. Hey, I heard this, and I'm going to spit it back out. Which is why I get a lot of people calling me saying, you know, or sending me emails saying, I don't hear this stuff anywhere else. Yeah, because there's really no critical thought going on in mainstream media. Why? Not because the people sitting behind the microphone or the television camera aren't smart people, aren't critical thinkers. It's that the people who are putting them on and paying their salaries. So you say that, you'll find yourself out on the street corner. So do you like your six-figure salary? Do you like your star status? Then you better shut up and do what you're told. That's reality. In my view, this stuff would have never gotten away with during my grandparents' generation, never. And I guess to me it highlights the success, really, and I've talked about this a lot over the years. You go back and you read the Powell memo from 1971, where Lewis Powell, the soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice, wrote a piece for the Chamber of Commerce to go after consumer advocates like Ralph Nader and go after those liberal professors and go after those news programs who are undermining the confidence of the public. And you need to give them some propaganda like, hey, tax cuts create jobs. It is repeated so often that it just comes out of our mouths like it's automatic. You know, I coach my daughter's basketball team, and one of the things I tell the girls when they're practicing is you've got to practice everything the right way. Your shot, you got to make sure your elbow's in, you got to make sure you follow through. Everything's got to be the same way. You've got to practice it the same over and over and over and over and over again so that come game time, it's automatic. You don't even think about it. It's just bang, the elbow's in, the hand goes. It's automatic. This is where we are. We've been trained. It's been regurgitated to us time and time and time and time and time and time again. And it's just, hey, it's the natural response. It's the same thing with the, oh, regulations, job-killing regulations. Oh, we've heard it so often that we start buying it. Yeah, there's a regulation in place that might hinder my job. Oh, can't have regulations. And I was thinking about today as I was hitting every single red light driving to the courthouse. You know, these time-killing red lights, they're hindering my productivity. We should just do away with red lights because it's holding me back. I could get so much more done. And I look at this and I go, you know, it's just we've just been inundated with it. And we've given so much power to the very well-to-do because we've got a campaign finance system that is so screwed up. Where the more money you have, the bigger your company is, the more lobbyists you can hire, the more power you have. And the more things you get, the more handouts you get, the more money you get to put in your pocket, the more power and influence. And then you get people who are defending CEOs. Oh, well, if you talk bad about CEOs, they won't like it and they won't come. They'll come if there's a business opportunity, there's a buck to be made. And we used to think businesses were tools to make society a little bit better, to give workers jobs, to be able to... We used to think that way. Now we think, well, we're only here to feed the businesses. It's silly to me. And I remember in 2010, I had a couple of Tea Party friends who said, well, Rick, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. What do you think the billions and billions of dollars in handouts to these companies, what do you think that is? The billions that we took out of public education to hand out to big corporations, the billions we took out of social services so we could keep the Delaware loophole open so corporations didn't have to pay taxes. Now, look, I'm not talking about all. I'm an enormous fan of small businesses. But when you're talking about a multi-state, multinational corporation who's got the power and influence to buy lobby firms who are going to go out there and pound our politicians senseless until they get what they want, those are the companies, those are the businesses, those are the people I have a problem with. And you look at this redistribution of wealth, massive amounts of money, and a very conservative number, most economists think, came out from a guy named Kenneth Thomas. He's a professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, political science professor, who points out that the redistribution of wealth by the states in this country to businesses, us giving money to the big corporations, runs in excess of $70 billion each and every year. What if I said we need $70 billion to feed our children? Oh, the sky would fall. We need $70 billion to invest in higher education. Oh, the sky would fall. Arrows flying in every direction. It would be the end of sanity. Oh, I can't believe you would talk about infrastructure or education or health care. Oh, health care. Obamacare is going to destroy the nation. $70 billion at least we hand to these big companies. Now, study after study has shown, you know what? The money that we give to these companies doesn't come back in job creation. And in fact, there was a study done by the Center for Effective Government, which I've talked about a couple of times, that pointed out that the 30 corporations that paid the highest tax rates, the 30 of the Fortune 500 who paid the highest, you know, you're 1 through 30, they created right around 200,000 jobs from 2008 to 2010. Now, in contrast, the 30 at the very bottom who paid the lowest tax rates, they fired in excess of 51,000 people. So this whole idea that if we give them money, they'll create jobs is on its face ridiculous. But the facts are in. The studies are there. And the common sense should have gotten us there before the studies had to be ever done. It doesn't work. You know, you go back to the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, the Republican socialist, with a top marginal tax rate of 92%, a corporate tax rate well north of what we're paying now. And you know what? The economy didn't collapse. In fact, thrived. You had a strong, burgeoning middle class with a decent social safety net. Huh. Wonder how they did that. Well, they didn't do it by saying, tax cuts for everybody, low taxes. I mean, we've been just hammered with that. But it comes back down to the money that the likes of the Koch brothers hand out. And you point to Florida State University, any number of universities across this country, where the Kochs gave $2 million, $2 million with an M, to Florida State University so that they could have veto power over any economics professor hired in their economics department. Do you think that's power? Do you think it's power to have every professor who's going to teach every kid who will come out of there in the next 20, 30 years believing that if we give more money to these big corporations, we're going to create jobs? Think that's power? You bet you're behind it is. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
1-888-520 Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So just to finish this up, because, you know, I look at it, and we've been just sold this false bill of goods, where state after state competing against each other. You know, in my neighborhood, Carlisle Tire and Wheel had been in that community for 93 years. They were the staple of the community. And because the state of Tennessee gave them like $34 million and a whole bunch of, you know, land grants and all kind of stuff, you name it, they threw, here, take it all. They left. And the community's left with this hole, a couple hundred jobs. And you go, okay, was it good for the country? Was it good for the nation as a whole? The company got a nice chunk of money, $34 million is what I saw. They moved the, I think it was 300 and some odd jobs that they had there down to Tennessee, and created, I shouldn't even say that. It took them 400 people to do what they used to do here with 330, say. So they added 70 jobs, but their payroll was considerably less. So answer me the question, is that good for the country? Because there are some who believe, well, the companies were able to cut costs, and they're more competitive. But was it good for the country? Was it good for the economy as a whole? And that's what this fighting between states has brought us. And I look at some of the states around the country. Ohio, where I grew up, you know, in where I went to high school, American Greetings was the big company, the staple company in the community that funded a lot and paid a lot of the taxes so that the school district had what it needed. It had auto shop, it had machine shop, it had electronics, it had cosmetology, it had all kind of vo-tech programs right there in the school. You didn't have to travel halfway across the country to get to one. Had excellent educational opportunities. But then came the tax abatements. And then went away auto shop and went away machine trades, went away, electronics. Then all the other things went with it. Now you put kids on a bus and send them over to a private interest that you're paying. And what did American Greetings do? Well, they not only shook the state down for about $110 million, they shook the city down and the local municipality for a boatload of money. And you got to ask the question, if we don't have this situation where we're pitting states against one another, based purely on rearranging the deck chairs of the Titanic, because we're not creating jobs, and that's the thing that gets me. Okay, we've stolen some jobs from someone else. Is that the kind of national policy we want to have? Is that smart? And I say no. I'm in favor of going, okay, you got an idea? Let's try and get you some low cost loans. There's an idea. You know, help you with technology. Help you make, you know, go through the regulations. I'm okay with those kind of helps. Handing cash to corporations to move from one city to another city. Just ludicrous. Because when you look at it, the big picture, you go, well, we actually lost money. We lost revenue. We lost economic activity. That money that consumers and workers used to have in their pockets that they would spend at other establishments, now gone. And you go, is that good? And the answer is, in my view, no. And you look across the country, you go, Jan Brewer in Arizona. Kasich in Ohio, this Branstad and Iowa, Walker in Wisconsin, all had these grandiose promises. We're going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs, like the guy in Iowa. Going to create 200,000 jobs, 11 he's come up with. He's still got 26 months to get to the other 189,000, but I wouldn't hold my breath. And they've all set up these private, public, private interests. We're using public money, but it's a private interest who's doing this economic development. And their jobs are, here's a whole boatload of money. And I look at Arizona, where they hired this guy, Don Cardin. Paid him $300,000 a year. Gave him a $50,000 signing bonus, $1,000 a month for a car allowance. And if he gave away a lot of money, they'd give him a $75,000 performance bonus. Wow, lots of money. Now understand, $300,000 is triple what the governor makes in that state and double what our governor makes. His job, giving away state money. And they didn't even really do that well. He ended up leaving the job, going from the public-private partnership to the private partnership where they paid him handsomely. Kind of like, thank you. Thank you for all the money. Now you can come work for us. Kasich, the Ohio governor, gave away $500 million in his first year as governor while gutting education and trying to steal workers' collective bargaining rights. I mean, it's just, you go, am I missing something here? This idea that we need to race to the bottom. This idea that we need less regulation and do away with those unions so we can steal jobs from someone else seems to me to be the wrong direction that we should be going. And politicians who espouse those views, those values, if you will, we should be dumping quickly. Because the reality is we're all in the shark tank. And that kind of mentality does us all a disservice. That kind of mentality does us all the wrong way. But it's what we've been sold. It's what we've been spoon-fed. And the hope is we're waking up. And I think we are. I think the more we see this beggar-thy-neighbor economic development falling flat on its face, the more we're going to ask the questions, is it doing us any good? And I say no. Quick break, back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're not against trade in the Steelworkers Union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The Steelworkers Union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their heads in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop that from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this PAC on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade in natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Here, so you're safe to exploit our workforce all you want. Don't worry, we won't get in your way. In fact, we'll help you. And today is a sad anniversary as Michigan joined the likes of the South Carolina types, and Michigan became the 24th state to ram through right-to-work legislation, or as I call it, the No Rights at Work agenda. Here again, this is one of the reasons I'm against the idea of term limits. You had these folks who... they knew they were going to have to, they were done, they were term limited, there was no consequence for them, so they rammed through this horrible piece of legislation. In fact, two of them, one for private sector workers, one for public sector workers, did it in 5 days, the quickest way legally possible in Michigan. The governor hurried up and signed it. It became law, basically, you know, guaranteeing that the workforce in Michigan will enjoy the things that South Carolina and other right-to-work states get. Lower wages, less benefits, less health care, like Zach Womp said. Sad, sad day. Anyway, let's talk to our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, Rick. How are you?
Sad day. You know, the first anniversary of Michigan becoming a no rights at work state.
Yeah, it is a sad day. It's intriguingly enough, it's a day that I have on my calendar and I light a candle because I'm old enough and experienced enough to remember when places like Michigan were not in a position where they used the law to crack and break the rights of workers to have a decent way of life. And decent income, decent access to health care, decent education for their children, decency and dignity at work. And so today's that anniversary that I light a candle because Michigan was really among the last places I had expected in my lifetime to see such an extraordinary shift. And we're working hard, and we're going to bring it back. We're going to repeal that law someday, and repeal it in Indiana as well, and start to do what we need to do. And that's organize workers and stop the politicians from using the government to interfere with the free right to contract between employers and unions.
Yeah, but before we do all that, we need to make sure that Pennsylvania doesn't become the 25th right-to-work state. As we all know, the same forces, the same moneyed interests are here as well, pushing that garbage here.
No question about it. And we know that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has it on their agenda. And there is a minority, very vocal minority, of the membership of the General Assembly that is agitating for this, and the outsiders are agitating with them. And the governor, who only a couple of weeks ago announced that he thought that he had a right and has a right to be reelected to his office and to have the citizens of Pennsylvania keep on the payroll for four more years, has announced with clarity that if the General Assembly sends him a right-to-work bill, he's ready to sign. So we do have our work here in Pennsylvania cut out for us, and we need to be ever vigilant and completely prepared to deal with this onslaught that they may just try to do like they did in Michigan and in Indiana and a hybrid of it in Wisconsin, where they hide it till the last minute and then try to manipulate constitutional provisions in the state constitution to allow them to pass legislation outside of the constitutionally guaranteed process. So we got to keep our eyes open, and we got to keep our pens and paper and emails and telephones and fax machines at the ready, so that if these bums try to do it to us here, we can fight back and fight back effectively.
Yeah, but Irwin, don't you know we need to be business friendly? And if we don't pass something disastrous like this, we can't steal jobs from someone else because they're all doing it, don't you know? And we've got to do what they're doing.
Well, the race to the bottom is filled with silliness just like what you've articulated. You know, if we attract business by having people who can't afford to buy what they make, who can't afford to even eat at the shoddy McDonald's or buy a loaf of bread at the grocery store in their neighborhood, or can't buy even the shoes that are made in China and sent here for their kids when they're going back to school, what have we accomplished? That's not pro-business. This is a consumer-based economy in which we live, so in order for consumers to be able to consume, they have to have something with which to consume, and they need the wages and the benefits that allow them to do that. And our seniors need to know that they'll have an opportunity to retire in dignity and with some independence. And our children need to know that the promise of a better life for them than their parents had is real and meaningful, and that we don't have to have a Pennsylvania brain drain. Recognize, of course, that here in Pennsylvania we have among the finest universities on the planet, and our kids go to these schools and then leave because already we're stuck with a low-wage economy in many respects, and when the economy was converted from a manufacturing base to a service-based economy, we lost a lot of kids, and we keep losing our kids, and the way to get them and keep them is to have decent, good-paying, high-road job with family-sustaining wages and family-sustaining benefits. And that just doesn't happen in the so-called right-to-work that I call right-to-rack, that you call right-to-work for, no right-to-work and right-to-work for less. We have all kinds of monikers, but in the end, what we really know is that in every right-to-work state, in every state that has passed the right-to-work law, whether it's the recent one in Michigan or the long-standing ones going back to the late 1940s and 2000 in the far west, everything is supposed to be up is down, and everything is supposed to be down is up. And we can't take that in Pennsylvania, and that's not the plan or the recipe for being pro-business. Being pro-business is being in a position where people have a living wage and life and family-sustaining benefits that allow them to live and consume and buy a new car every now and again, pay for the new roof on the house, and maybe even buy a refrigerator, and from time to time get a vacation.
Oh, pshaw, heaven forbid. No, we can't have that. Because, you know, we want to, it seems to me we're moving towards an economy that's going to match us like Bangladesh, where workers don't have a voice and work in unsafe conditions because they don't have all those pesky regulations. See, to be business friendly now, what I'm told, and I've been told this a couple of times, we need to have lower taxes, we need to have no regulations, and no workers' rights. That's the recipe for success, I'm told. Didn't you get the memo?
I missed that memo, apparently, because I've known for years, natively and through my own observation, that a high road economy with decent wages and family-sustaining benefits is the way that all ships get raised. We've learned just by watching the ocean that a rising tide raises all ships. And we know that working people spend what they earn, and that makes the economy work. And we know that people at the top that are making 12 and 1,500 times what their workers are earning aren't spending that money. You know how many houses and how many yachts and how many Cadillacs and Mercedes Benzes can one family use? And after that, they sock the money away, and it doesn't drive the economy. It drives down life in every possible respect. And you don't have to take my word for it. Just look at the statistics coming out of that same South Carolina, whose governor you were repeating for us just before this segment started. Life ain't so grand in South Carolina where they bust them unions. So we know better. We've learned better. We've lived better. And we owe it to our children and we owe it to our grandparents to assure that it doesn't happen here, that we have the line drawn.
Let me ask you this. I want to change topics for a second, slightly, because you saw the infrastructure, the transportation bill that passed. I don't think it was enough, but I look at it, and the pound of flesh, or one of the many pounds of flesh that came out of it, was this changing of the prevailing wage, which to me just seems ideological more than actually fiscal. I'm curious of your thoughts on the transportation bill and the pound of flesh that they extracted from workers.
Well, they stole it from workers. They didn't extract the pound of flesh from workers. They stole from Pennsylvania taxpayers, because if they were serious about this, what they did, just so there isn't any confusion, what they did in the General Assembly is, in order to get a few votes from anti-tax right-wing legislators, they increased the threshold before minimum wage standards for skilled, trained, and experienced construction workers apply on projects funded by the liquid fuel tax that's going to go up by 28.5 cents a gallon. They increased that by 400%. And with that, they eliminated coverage for thousands and thousands and thousands of taxpayer jobs. But when they did that, if they were serious, if the rhetoric was to be matched by the reality, they would have required an associated cut in the cost to every public body that does public work in this range of these 400% increase of attachment point or threshold. They didn't require any cut. So this is not anything that is going to save taxpayers money. All it's going to do is take money out of the pockets of trained, skilled, experienced, hardworking Pennsylvanians out of their paycheck every week when they finally get to work on these jobs that are to be funded by this tax increase. And it'll be placed instead in the hands of the contractors who do the work. The taxpayers will have the same bill either way, or fundamentally the same bill, maybe a couple of dollars one way or another, but there's not going to be the savings that was alleged to be the basis for this. And we know that because the only statistics we have when prevailing wages were slashed back in the days of Tom Ridge being governor and Johnny J. Butler being the Secretary of Labor and Industry. Direct inverse proportional relationship, Rick. When the wages were slashed and cut, the cost per square foot of building a school building actually not only didn't stay the same, it went up. It went up.
So there's nothing in this that says that we as taxpayers have to save something? Because I would think that you would throw in there, say, well, if it doesn't come to fruition, this doesn't happen. We undo this because it was obviously then a bad idea, right?
It's obviously a bad idea, and everybody just was so caught up in this silly political game that was being played that they neglected to deal with the reality. The reality would have been to require every bid on every job to be cut by the percentage that allegedly is associated with the putative increase in the cost of work because workers are to be paid the prevailing minimum wage in their trades or crafts in the community in which they're working. Remember that prevailing wages come from the marketplace in a local community. So contractors don't pay their workers more than the local wage that can be sustained in that community. But the theory behind those who advocated this 400% increase, imagine 400% increase, never happened before anywhere in my lifetime. But those who advocated seemed to think and say and represent, with a straight face nonetheless, that there was nothing whatsoever related to the market. So the market that they worship, that capitalist market that they deify, when it came to the requirement of paying the prevailing local wages in trades or crafts. Remember, prevailing doesn't mean average wage. It means the most frequently paid. The example that I've used in the past, that was taught to me by a great man who passed away recently, Glenn Schaefer, former president of Pennsylvania Building Trades. Glenn used to say with crystal clarity that if you have a parking lot that has 10 red cars and 5 blue cars, the prevailing color is not purple. And so it is with wages. So the prevailing wage is the wage most frequently paid in a community. It is determined by what the marketplace has. But
I've been told I've been told numerous times that's the dreaded union wage.
Well, there's no such thing as a union wage. And I'm glad you said that because it gives me a chance to try to explain something. And I don't know how well or artfully I'll do it, but I'm going to give it a shot. Unions in this country do not have the capacity to impose any wage or any benefit or any working condition on anybody. Wages earned by union members are the product of negotiation with employers. In the case of the construction industry, they're the product of negotiation with individual employers or sometimes with contractor associations, employer associations, but all based upon what the employers and the union together negotiate and agree upon. It's not anything that the unions impose. So anybody who talks anywhere about a so-called union wage is a fool or a liar. There's a marketplace wage, and unions and employers sitting together rationally work that out and come to an agreement about what the union is willing to accept and what the employer is willing to pay. In the non-union sector, there is no market wage. There is the wage that the employer grudgingly pays in order to get somebody to do the job. All too often, as we've seen in places like, you know, as far ranging as, for example, in Lancaster County, the McCaskey High School, is when the employer that did the work turned out to not have been paying the prevailing wage, but to paying skilled workers the wage for unskilled workers and calling people by trades other than the ones in which they're actually working. The school that was supposed to open in August of a couple of years ago, with the new school year, opened for a day and then had to be shut down immediately because it was falling apart and dangerous, and our children were about to be exposed to that danger along with their teacher. So there are issues here, and I'm very worried that the bridges and roads and highways and streets that are supposed to be addressed by this very dramatic increase in liquid fuel tax are going to be repaired, renovated, replaced, or originally built by people who are working not for the prevailing wages in the community, but for the wages that the employers that employ them on these jobs because of this dramatic change in the prevailing wage applicability to these road construction jobs, this 400% increase in the attachment point for prevailing wage requirements apply. I'm very worried that the quality of work will not be there because when you pay substandard wages to people, you get substandard work very often. And that's not to criticize anybody that will be working on the job. That's just to recognize that the people who are trained, who go through state-supervised and state-registered apprenticeship programs, who spend years learning their trades and crafts before they do these jobs, are the ones into whose arms we entrust the safety of our children, of our parents, of our grandparents, in all manner of public construction, from town halls and libraries and so on, to our school buildings, to our streets, roads, and bridges.
And to my own house. I mean, to speak testament to that, you know, I have a trained union electrician who comes and does all my electrical work because I'm not putting my fingers on it. Or as my wife said, I'm not going to let you burn the house down.
Well, exactly right. I mean, you know, those union, well-trained, highly skilled, completely apprenticed electricians don't jump on the radio every night and try to run a radio show because that's not what they do and that's not what they're trained to do. That's what you do because that's what the product of your training and understanding is. And so it goes. So there are issues here, real big and serious issues. And all that's exacerbated. This morning there was an article in the New York Times, no less, about companies that are getting federal contracts that have just deplorable records of violating federal workplace safety and workplace wage protection laws. And it turned out that in just a couple of years' time, contractors that had gotten billions of dollars worth of government contracts paid for by the taxpayers, paid for by working men and women, paid also fines of in excess of $198 million, Rick, for violations of the Occupational Safety and Health Law, for violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act, for violations of the wage and hour laws, for violations of child labor laws. And that's breathtaking, and we need to address that issue. And we need to make sure not only that we have contractors paying prevailing wages on these kinds of public works contracts, whether it's for services or construction, but also that we have in place responsible contractor laws that would require bidders, in order to be deemed to be responsible bidders on public works projects, demonstrate that they haven't violated equal employment opportunity laws, occupational safety and health laws, fair labor standards laws, wage payment and collection laws, child labor laws, employee retirement income security laws, etc. And that's the next opportunity that we're going to have to explore and hopefully succeed at in order to protect people at the workplace whose jobs are being financed by we taxpayers.
And that fight, I'm sure, will be coming soon and as early as tomorrow, I wouldn't doubt.
We're in the process of drafting ordinances for several cities even as we speak.
Well, as those things come up, I wish you'll come back and tell us what's going on. Keep us informed. Keep us up to date. Irwin, I appreciate the time. I wish you and your family the absolute best holiday and in the new year. And I'll talk to you soon.
Good. I look forward to that. And good holidays to you and your good family and the kiddies, and also to all of our listeners. Thanks so much. And may we all have a better and happier time by this time next year in a state that is a little more safe and a little more secure for working men.
All righty. Irwin, always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking the time for us. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
A, quote, message of the week is handed out. Talking points, including lines of attack, are distributed. Social media tactics are taught. New messaging tools like digital flyers are deployed. Opinion articles are pre-written, and a 17-page playbook lays out the strategy. All this and much more is part of an all-out centralized military-style assault that House Republicans are making in a desperate attempt to kill Obamacare, with their larger mission being to crush the idea that every American deserves good quality health care. The campaign is being directed through Speaker John Boehner's office, with all 231 GOP members expected to take marching orders, penetrate every media market, and stir up as much negative noise as possible to sabotage Obama's Affordable Care Act. Most members of this anti-care brigade, however, seem blissfully unaware of an explosive irony in their furious assault on Obamacare. It was their idea. While Democrats long advocated that universal health care should be achieved by simply extending Medicare to everyone, Republicans always countered that coverage should be run through the insurance corporations, with a requirement that younger and healthier people buy into it. Richard Nixon proposed this concept in 1974. Then, in 1989, the Heritage Foundation, a Republican allied think tank, basically proposed the full privatized system embodied in the ACA, including the individual mandate that everyone buy an insurance policy. Such far right-wing GOP Congress critters as Senator Orrin Hatch and Newt Gingrich became leading champions of this scheme, the very one that they and fellow Republicans are now trying to demonize and slay. This is Jim Hightower saying, the deeper irony is that should the GOP succeed, Democrats can then return to the more sensible plan of Medicaid for all.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls came down.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Just to go back over that for a second, because, you know, to me, that ideological pound of flesh, that ideological theft of wages, based not on reality, based not on actual savings, because as Irwin pointed out, the last time they tried this scheme, it actually cost we the taxpayers more money. And I can't believe that there's nothing in there that says we actually have to save something. I mean, that just blows my mind. You're saying we're literally going to steal wages from people, and we're not going to benefit from it. We're just going to hurt them. Does that seem sane? Does it seem rational? And I look at places that have done it and have left it in place. Fortunately, when it happened here in Pennsylvania, they immediately figured it out. Not immediately, it took a little bit of time. But they figured it out and said, well, this is bad. It's bad for our economy. It's bad for our building trades. It's bad for our projects. And they undid it. But in places where they have it, and I look at Utah as one of those places, you had a massive brain drain. If you're going from making $20 an hour to, you know, being a carpenter or electrician or whatever the prevailing wage was, down to, you know, 15 or 12 or who know 10, who knows, you're going to leave. You're going to look for somewhere else, and you end up having a massive brain drain, and that brain drain then puts you in a position where now we've got people who aren't as well trained. And one of the great secrets, I think, of the union building trades is their apprenticeship programs. The fact that they train people and pay them. Think about the corporate model and what we've done with education. When I was a kid going to school, there were the programs, the VOTEC programs that were in your local schools. You learn the basics of being an electrician. You learn the basics of being a machinist. You learn the basics of being, an auto mechanic, a carpenter. You learn the basics of these things. And then you went on into the union apprenticeship programs, and you got a job. So right out of high school, 18 years old, you were making, at the time, I think they were paying like 12, 13 bucks an hour to learn the skill, to learn the trade. And for a couple of years, you were an apprentice until you got your journeyman papers, and then you made a little bit better money and a living wage with benefits and all that stuff. And you had benefits when you were doing the apprenticeship program. Well, the corporate solution is, well, there are people who want this. We're going to take it from the schools. We'll put it for a private company who will then charge the school districts a boatload of money to administer and do all the things, because they're going to save a little bit of money, and we're going to profit from it. And give a little, maybe not such a great, maybe not as good, who knows. And then those union apprenticeship programs, you don't need that. Here, come to XYZ Technical College, and we'll teach you how to swing a hammer. And you'll pay us. I mean, it's been masterful how these corporatists, how these big moneyed interests, it's been masterful how they have convinced us that, those unions are bad. I learned to drive a truck, and I go back to being a young man. I learned to drive a truck because the company and the union had an agreement that, you know what, we're not going to look outside of our ranks. If there's someone who works on the dock, if there's someone who wants to learn, we're going to teach them before we hire somebody else to be a jockey in the yard. And that's how I learned to drive. Today, that's all gone. Companies don't want any part of training their workforce. They want no part of it. That's an expense we don't need to have. Now, granted, I came in at my lunch hour. I went in after work for an hour or two, and I learned from other people who had done it, and really in the best way possible by experiencing it. I now see, and this is one of the big growing fields where there's a lot of state money, a lot of federal money going into training truck drivers, giving these companies, here's a boatload of cash. Train somebody and hire them. Or worse yet, like I saw a couple weekends ago when I was coming back from New York when I was doing my weekend gig. There's a particular place I stop in Allentown every Sunday when I drive to grab a hot dog. It's just a bad habit, I guess. And in there are a couple of guys who with the community college logo on the side of the truck. And I'm going, how much are you paying for this? And they said, they're paying, several thousand dollars to learn how to drive a truck and, all of this stuff. And I'm going, really? And how much do you think you're going to make? Oh, $60,000, $70,000 a year. And I'm going, really? Interesting money if you can get it. Chances are you're not. Most of the truck drivers I know who aren't covered by union contracts or the ones that aren't breaking the law, they're nowhere near that. But good luck. I wish you the best. But they've turned it around. Now you've got these kids who are coming out of these training programs in debt to learn to drive a truck. To me, something completely foreign. And I guess my problem is I remember being a young man where there were these kind of opportunities, where there were entry-level opportunities that you got trained to move up. Maybe instead of now, it's all corporate. It's all, hey, fork out some cash because you're investing in yourself. How much of that nonsense have you heard? Take on $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 in debt because you're investing in yourself. It's ludicrous. And I look at this generation of kids who are saddled with massive student loan debt because, well, there are no jobs for them to go into, no entry-level jobs that are given the training. The only entry-level jobs are minimum wage, McDonald's, retail jobs, fast food jobs that pay basic minimum wage with very little advancement. But I guess if you want welfare and if you want, some subsidies, there's some help there a little bit. But you'll be degraded and humiliated. But I look at this and I go, by degrading the wages that these construction workers make, you're destroying this whole system. And to me, that seems to be the goal. I look at my own household. We're doing a bunch of remodeling and, putting some lights in and moving outlets around. My wife's got a whole a whole lot of stuff to do, and a bunch of stuff that has been bugging her about the house, because we've decided this is where we're going to stay. We had talked about moving, but we decided this is where we are. House is paid for, this is where we are. So we're doing a bunch of work to try and get things situated. And I look at this guy who's a well-trained, highly trained union electrician, was referred to me by a friend who's the head of one of the local electrician unions. Said this guy does this, he'll fix you up. And he gets things done. It would take me an entire day. Does it about 15, 20 minutes. That's the difference between I'll figure it out and I know what the hell I'm doing. My concern, once we allow the building trades to be destroyed, you're going to get a lot of people going, I'll figure it out. I'll figure out how this concrete goes down on the bridge. I'll figure out where these screws go. I'll figure out why we need bolts. Yeah. I don't know that I want that stuff built by folks who I'll figure it out. I want people who know what they're doing. Let's take a quick break. I'm right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're not against trade in the Steelworkers Union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The Steelworkers Union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their head in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track Authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop that from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this PAC on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade and natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
One 520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So it was 1951 today, back in 1951, 10 days after an Illinois state mine inspector approved a process of removing coal dust from the New Orient mine in West Frankfort, Illinois. Guess what happened? Yeah, you guessed it. The mine went boom. And why did it go boom? Well, because of the dust accumulation. How many people died for that mistake? 119 workers died that day. And I hear people say, well, we've got onerous regulations. Oh, job-killing regulations. Oh, this OSHA is just, oh, they're rogue. I think the one representative from Pennsylvania said, there's an organization, her name's Marguerite C. Quinn, a Republican from Bucks County. OSHA's an organization that's gone rogue. Had to steal that from Sarah Palin, I guess. But, you know, you look at this and you go, very real examples in our history of working people being killed on the job. And I've said this, and I'll say it maybe until it changes. Maybe at some point down the road, you will see somebody prosecuted and thrown in jail. But if I wanted to kill somebody, if I really had it in for somebody, I wanted to kill them, I'd just hire them. Sure, come on, you come work for me. And then you set up a dangerous condition. They die on the job, you pay a little fine, and you walk down the road. I was in West Texas, the city of West in Texas, where the fertilizer plant there, who needs those regulations? We had ammonium nitrate, huge amounts of it, that blew a 10-foot deep, 93-foot wide hole in the earth, knocked homes off their foundations, blew the roof and the windows and a half of the building of a nursing home off its foundation. The school blew the windows out. This town just, almost like a ghost town when we went through it. But it's, you know, Rick, it's those job-killing regulations. There are example after example. And I look at this story that was sent to me. Here in Pennsylvania, there's a company, the American Bar Company, American Bar Products Incorporated. The owner, evidently, so OSHA inspected his workplace, which, amazing to be honest with you, with his many cuts in staffing and they've defunded OSHA. It's amazing that if you get inspected in this day and age, honestly and truthfully, this is just reality. If you get inspected by OSHA in this day and age, there's a reason. They have gutted their funding so badly that to inspect every workplace in this country just once would take 111 years. So when they come knocking on the door, there's something there. Like they say, when there's smoke, there's fire. Something there. Well, the guy who owned the place says, well, I'm not letting you in. Because the federal government, I do not respect it, he says. It's my business. You can't come in. So they come back with a warrant, and he has to let them in. And, you know, and I love his claim. A disgruntled employee complained. Disgruntled employee. And I love one of the statement in the article at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He said, quote, and you can't make this up, this is a dangerous place to work. It's noisy, it's dusty, it's greasy. So I might get in trouble saying that. Well, if you're admitting it's a dangerous place to work, then maybe you should try and make it a little bit safer. And he goes on to say, well, you know, the people know the risks. And they work safe. But they know it's dangerous. They know the risks. And, you know, I look at this. Now, this is a company that makes brings in $10 million in revenue. It's a $10 million company. Now, it's not a huge corporation. They've got 11 employees. The argument is they're trying to put me out of business, a job-killing organization. They're going to put my 11 people out of work because we want to make sure that they're safe. And I look at this, and you know, I kind of step back and I go, their argument is we then have to have unsafe workplaces where workers have no voices in order for us to have productivity and have jobs. Because in the article, it says he believes that the regulations are a hindrance to productivity. And look, you know, as I said earlier, traffic lights are a hindrance to me getting home. Should we do away with them? The school zone, where my kids go to school, the 15-mile-an-hour speed limit is a hindrance to me getting home. And you go, but Rick, you know, the red lights are there for a reason. It's so that all the cars don't smash into each other. Well, boy, you know it's dangerous. You know when you go to that intersection you should stop, so the free market should do it. You know when you're going through the speed zone a kid might run out? Well, you might not care. I got to get home. Hooray for me. Screw everybody else. But you know that, Rick. You know. And I go and I say, you know the regulations that we have in place? We learned the lessons of the past. 119 people today, back in 1951. 119 people went to work thinking they were entering a dangerous workplace, but that they expected because the company said, hey, we've got this technique, going to pull the dust out, going to pull this combustible dust out of the air, and you're going to be safe. You're going to go home tonight to your family. You just go and you work hard, and you bring us the coal. 119 people didn't go home to their families tonight back in 1951. You go, but Rick, that was so long ago. And do you know why it was so long ago, folks? Because each one of those catastrophes, each one of those tragedies, we said, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? How do we make sure that tomorrow when those folks go back to work, when you or your loved ones go to work, that they come home alive and healthy? How do we make sure of that? And I guess the other question I then have, how much of your life should you give up in order to make a living? I mean, this amazingly, I'm shocked that the guy who owns this company says this is a dangerous place to work. I'm shocked at it. Are we going back to the arguments of yesteryear? Or, hey, you knew it was dangerous. When you came to work, you knew it was dangerous. So when you chopped off your arm, that's your fault. Because I look at the assaults on all of the things that we've put in place to protect workers and to help folks. All of that's under assault right now. Every bit of it. The Koch brothers and the wealth class of this country, they have got their guns aimed on everything that protects you and me and others. Because it's job killing. Everything's a job killer. Everything. We need no taxes. We need low taxes. You find out a large number of these huge corporations, they don't pay any tax. What do you mean we need low taxes? How much lower can we go? How much lower than zero is there? Well, we can do like we do with General Electric. Give them money. And I guess I'm just on this, because I've had a lot of email interaction the last couple of days on this very topic, on the idea of creating jobs. Because, look, I've said before, I'm in favor of job creation. I'm in favor of small businesses competing. I'm in favor of that. The problem is you've got these huge multinationals, these huge multi-state corporations who are manipulating the hell out of the system. And now you've got these people who see an opportunity. Well, you know what? If they're not going to follow the rules, why should I? If they're not going to pay tax, why should I? And what we're going to see is a spiraling down, and there's really nothing we're going to be able to do. And I guess at some point now, we need to start having those conversations. How much of your life are you willing to give up to have a job? You look at the statistics, somewhere near 5,500 to 6,000 people go to work, and they don't come home each and every year in this country. Somewhere between 5,500 and 6,000. Beyond that, somewhere between 50 and 60,000 people die every year of occupational illnesses. That's the exposure to the chemicals that you were using while you were doing whatever it is you were doing. That's the exposure to whatever the injuries you may have had while working for certain dangerous jobs. Because like he says, dangerous. He admits it. Dangerous. So when OSHA cited him with 13 violations, 10 of them they labeled serious. And when they label serious violations and you only are assessed a $13,000 penalty, which eventually you only pay reduced down to $8,400, you go, how pathetic. I mean, you're talking about a serious violation. I mean, if they're really serious violations, shouldn't they come with serious consequences? And that's my problem. This ludicrous notion that, oh, they're job-killing regulations. Get out of here. But I guess the people who would espouse that, the people who would throw that out at you, are the people who don't give a damn about you. Now, I was talking to a guy today. He said, you know, when this company bought up the company he had worked for, they treat him now like he's just a number, like he's a tool, can be disposed of at any time. And the sad reality is that's how corporate America sees the American worker, as a disposable tool, because it's what they get away with in other countries. The question is it right? Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts.
Say the USA is drowning in craft lies. Say the USA, I've resumed the ties in mind. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job that you're in the
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see a resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. How many times have you heard on ads on radio or TV that if you bring an ad, a competitor's ad in, we'll match it, or we'll do better, or whatever the slogan is, because we won't be undersold. We'll do it. Well, this guy, a former professional wrestler, a disabled former professional wrestler, a guy named Joe Cantrell, he actually has a reputation as a guy who scans all of the promotional ads of all the different retailers and then goes and holds them to account. So the Walmart in Santan Valley, Arizona, is where he decided that he was going to go in and say, I have this ad. I want my product at the lower price. Well, they saw him coming. Employee stopped him at the door, said he wasn't allowed to ad match any longer. Nope, can't do it. And I'm going, wait a second. I thought if there was an ad, competitor's price, it was automatic. Oh, no. And I love some of those places who tell you, you just sign up for our card, and we'll send you a rebate if it ever happens, which good luck on that. Now, this disabled former wrestler, disabled guy, who I'm sure is a large man, evidently they claim, Walmart claims, scared the person behind the counter, so the police came, handcuffed him. Because he wanted what they promised. And, look, I've always known it's a bunch of, just a bunch of horse pucky. It's a bunch of nonsense. It's just that sales thing that they all say. That good luck actually trying to get them to live up to it. Now, this guy has been evidently doing it to the point where they know who he is. And they don't let him in. And you go, really? Should that be legal? I mean, isn't there something in that? And I'm waiting to see if a lawsuit comes out of this, especially after the guy was handcuffed and told that you can't do it. Now, will Walmart as a corporation stop advertising that? Probably. That'll probably be the thing. But here's the thing that gets me. It's already in our heads that we think that's it. So we think, well, it's the low prices. And as I talk to people who shop at Walmart often, they're telling me the prices aren't all that low. Wages are. Benefits are. Prices not so much. But you do know what is up? Subsidies. In fact, I just saw a report from the National Employment Law Project that I think we've talked about it a couple of times, that more than $1.2 billion in our money goes to them each and every year for those low wages. Because they're not low prices, just low wages. High profits, though, and that's what's important, is it not? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher, smartphone. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
We got to get older tonight. We got to do it today.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to Win Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're not against trade in the Steelworkers Union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The Steelworkers Union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their head in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop that from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this pact on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade in natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the big news last night was the budget agreement that Patty Murray and Paul Ryan have come up with. And the question I keep asking, is it good for us? Is this the right direction? Is this what we should be pursuing? It's compromise, they say, after all, and you don't always get what you want. Here to talk to us about the agreement and what it means is Dean Baker. He is an economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, the website. Dean, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
So, you know, I look at this and, you know, you write in this, in your piece, that this is convenient for members of Congress, but not so good for the rest of us.
Yeah, well, you know, they'd had some serious battles, the battle over the shutdown. We literally did have a government shutdown for 2.5 weeks back in October. We had the battle of debt ceiling, you know, within a few days of defaulting. We had that back in 2011 as well. We had a number of sort of close calls the last two and a half years ever since the Republicans gained control of Congress in 2011. And no doubt that's, you know, tense story for Congress. So what they did here was they sort of shook hands, didn't agree on too much, and they said this will cover us through 2015. So what that means for Congress is they aren't going to have any of these late night, you know, fight it out, you know, take it to the cliff deal. So, you know, for them, that's probably a good story. They're happy. You know, those weren't popular. You know, I'm sure they'd enjoy it, and they certainly made them unpopular with the public. But were some changes in the sequester, the cuts to large areas of the federal budget, which you could argue probably mostly for the good, but they're paid for, among other things, giving the federal employees a further hit. They're going to have to take a pay cut to give more money to their pension. They didn't extend unemployment benefits, so a lot of people, a lot of unemployed workers, laid-off workers, will see their benefits in. And most importantly, you know, for me, from the standpoint of looking at the economy as a whole, they're not doing anything to boost the economy. So, you know, we have an economy that's growing, you know, weekly. It's adding jobs, not at a particularly strong pace. Still a lot of people unemployed, underemployed. It doesn't do much about that. So, on the whole, I can't give very high marks.
Right. So, but no more of these 24 like hostage situations. No more of that until at least 2015. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So in that sense, it's good for them. And insofar as people were worried, you know, some cause that, you know, these things would blow up. And, of course, it did blow up when the government shut down for 2.5 weeks. We won't have to worry about that. But
what about the debt ceiling fight that's going to be coming up, I guess, on what, April?
Yeah, there's not, as far as I know, not an agreement on that. But I have to say I'd be very surprised if that blew up to be a big thing. I think, both sides recognize that that's not going to help them. So my guess is that you'll get some sort of deal equivalent to, if you recall, this year, 2013, we had a debt ceiling deadline in, I'm forgetting now whether it was late January or February, but in any case, they just agreed that they would suspend the debt ceiling for 6 months. So there was no big deal around that, no suspense. So my guess is they'll do something similar, that they're not going to have a big fight over it. They'll just, you know, find a way to paper it over and, you know, just walk away from it.
It may go back to what a former congressman we have on the program often said. You know, the debt ceiling used to be a yawn vote. You went in, you voted for it because you've already spent the money. The time to argue about the debt ceiling and about that was when you spent the money, not when it's due.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that, you know, when we had the last standoff, you know, we had, you know, the Republicans were the ones, of course, holding out, saying, oh, we're spending too much. And, you know, fine if you want to make that argument, but, you know, exactly right. I mean, it's like, you know, we run up a big credit card bill, and then we start having an argument over whether we should pay it. And, you know, this is kind of silly. Okay, maybe we bought too much. Well, then you have that argument at the point where you're getting, not at the point when it's time to pay your credit card.
Now let's talk about a couple of the big things in this. The not extending the unemployment insurance, the federal emergency extension benefits, to me seems really very short-sighted. I mean, and kind of Scrooge-ish, if you will. I mean, with this being the holidays and all, right now going, well, you know, we're going to cut you off right now. It just seems kind of a Scrooge deal.
Well, it is, and you know, there's some people saying, you know, I'm trying to remember. I don't want to libel the wrong person. So I'm not going to say the name, but I remember, you know, one of the Republicans saying something like, we're doing them a favor. We're doing the unemployed workers a favor because we're going to give them a chance to find jobs. And, you know, I can understand the logic of that, but we actually have had a lot of chance to test that. In other words, you know, we take away your benefits, you go, oh, what am I going to do? You know, I don't have my $300 a month in benefits. I better go out and find work, $300 a week. The reality is when people's benefits end, the overwhelming majority of those people give up looking for work. So what unemployment benefits do, you have to be actively looking for work to get benefits. So in that sense, you could say it increases the unemployment rate because we keep people looking for work who might otherwise have dropped out of the labor force. But the idea that there's all these people who are saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to get a job because I have benefits for another 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it might be, it's just, you know, it's just not the case. You know, not to say no one's ever ripped off the system, but clearly that's not what's going on with the vast majority of people who are getting benefits.
Or the people have said, you know, I have options right now. I may not take the first thing that comes along that was lower paying than what I was getting. I'm going to be maybe at the beginning a little choosy, but since the recession, that choosy, especially when you're looking at the beginning, you had five people looking for every one open job, and now it's just under four folks looking for every one open job. That doesn't seem to hold now.
No, and, you know, we've done some research on this. You find people with college degrees who are taking jobs at fast food restaurants. You know, so we have a lot of people who are, you know, well overqualified for the jobs that they're taking. So the idea that you have people holding out, you know, and again, some of that, yeah, of course, and that's exactly what you want. You know, if you have someone that's been an electrician, an engineer, you don't want to say, oh, take a job at McDonald's. You know, people put time, it's a loss both to those workers and to the economy. These are skills my view, that's a good thing. But when we're talking about someone who's been out of work 30, 40 weeks, they're not being choosy. They're taking whatever job they can find.
Yeah, and to go back to what you were saying about, Rand Paul recently said that by extending it would be a disservice to those.
That's the person I was thinking of. I'm glad you found out. I didn't want to. Yeah. It was my memory. It was Rand Paul, but I didn't want to say that without being certain of that.
He said it was, and it's kind of like the South Carolina congressman who said, Mama told me we don't feed dogs because then they'll just reproduce. It's that kind of very simplistic mentality that I think is very destructive, not just to our economy, but to individuals as well, especially the folks who are unemployed, because I know a number of people who have been unemployed for quite some time, and they've gotten into this system where nobody's willing to even give them an interview, let alone give them a job.
Yeah, and, again, this is the sort of thing that we actually have research on. So, again, we could all understand, and certainly there are people that, go, I don't have to work, I can get benefits. Certainly there are people like that, but we've done the research. We know it's a very small segment because we've had the opportunity to see people have gotten to the end of their, they're now at 73 weeks, earlier it had been 99. We know what happens to people when they hit the end of the benefit period. The overwhelming majority of those people either, some keep looking for work, but others just drop out of the labor force. It's not as though you get all these people go, okay, my benefits are ending, time to go out and get serious about finding a job. Very few people in that boat. So we don't really have to argue about that one. We've done
good.
The research.
Okay, well, in looking at that then, because here at the end of the year when the benefits run out, you're going to see, about a million people who are going to lose their benefits, and then in the middle of next year, about another million and a half? And, I was thinking about this when I saw the job numbers that just came out, said we're right about 7% unemployment. By kicking those 2.5 million people off the unemployment rolls, wouldn't we see a drop in the unemployment rate?
We likely will see some drop in the unemployment rate. Again, it's not for the reason we want to see it. We're going to see a drop in the unemployment rate because people no longer are looking for work. So
yeah, I wanted to get that out there because people say, well, when we get they think that by taking them off unemployment, the rate drops, that they actually went and got jobs, and that's not the case.
That's right. Again, overwhelmingly, you'll get people stop looking for work. Again, some might continue to look for work, so it's like accounts being unemployed, even though they're no longer getting the benefits. But the share, the percent that are suddenly going to find a job, those are few and far between. The point you were making earlier is actually an important point, that once people have been unemployed for a long period of time, they've been unemployed 30, 40, 50 weeks, it's hard for them even to get an interview. And again, people have done research on this. What they do is they write up two resumes, identical resumes. One of them, they say they've been unemployed 3 weeks. The other one, they say they've been unemployed 30 weeks. The people who've been unemployed 30 weeks almost never get called back. So, these people are really behind the eight ball. So to then turn around and point your finger at them, call them lazy, ripping off the government, that's just not the reality.
Yeah, like our governor. Our governor, first when he was running for election, called them lazy, and now they're drug addicts. Can't pass a drug test. That seems to be the latest in the line of assaults.
That seems a bigger problem for people in Congress.
Yeah, or as we saw today, some child porn allegations going on around one of the Republican senator's staff. But that's another story for another time. By cutting this unemployment, from an economist's view, what is it going to do to the economy? By taking that money out of the economy, what's it going to do?
Well, this is an important point people have to understand. We need money in the economy. And it's sort of bizarre how you get these discussions sometimes. We understand if we raise people's taxes, that's pulling money out of their pockets. And, of course, the Republicans are very big to jump up and say, how are you helping the economy? You're pulling money out. Well, in a downturn, that's exactly right. So raising taxes pulls money out of the economy. Same thing if we cut benefits. We have all these people. We'll have a million people that were going to get their checks. They're not big checks. They're somewhere around $300 a month, $300 a week on average. They aren't getting that money, which means when it comes to, buying things at the grocery store, buying clothes for their kids, paying their rent, there's payments that many of these people aren't going to be able to make. So that's going to slow economic growth and lead people to lose jobs. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates it'll slow growth by about 0.2 percentage point. That would translate into roughly 300,000 fewer jobs. It's not what we need right now.
Yep. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dean Baker, economist, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net, the web. Dean, I was looking at this, and for me, I've been saying for the longest time that, and this is just my view, you probably don't have to agree with me, but I didn't think any of the federal extensions should have really ever happened. I said the government should have been the employer of last resort. If you can't get a job after 26 weeks, we make sure that we don't let people sit idle. We don't have an idle workforce. We get people jobs. We get them doing something. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done that's not being done. I think there's got to be a full employment policy where we've got to be thinking anybody who wants a job, anybody who wants to earn a paycheck, there's a path to that.
Well, let me just put it this way. I think the reaction to this downturn has been appalling. I mean, we were hit with for a big loop, you know, when we had the collapse of the housing bubble and the financial crisis 2007-2008. It was the responsibility of the government to take that up to fill the hole in demand. Part of that could have been jobs, you know, just saying, okay, you know, you've been unemployed for however long, you know, 6 months, whatever the time period is, we'll find a job for you. But there were so many things that should have been, I mean, some of these things were on our stimulus list, but the problem was it was too small and too short. I mean, President Obama, unfortunately, I don't think ever really leveled with people about how big that hole was. You know, my calculations are we lost somewhere in the order of $1.2 trillion in annual demand when the housing bubble collapsed.
Wow.
And we're looking to replace that. The stimulus at its peak in 2009 and 2010 was about $300 billion a year. So it was nowhere near the right size. And, of course, it pretty much ended. I mean, it's a little spending that continued 2011-12 and even to this day, but basically ended after 2010. So we didn't have anywhere near a big enough response, and there's so many things. We should be retrofitting our homes, our businesses, government buildings, make them more energy efficient. You know, we could be doing a lot to improve generation of energy from solar, from wind. So these both reduce our energy consumption and would directly create jobs. And again, we did some of that, but we could have done that times five, times ten. That's exactly the point right now. We have people sitting around doing nothing. So a lot of those people could be putting solar panels on roofs, putting an insulation at home.
Yeah, but Dean, don't you know we're broke? We don't have any money. We're broke. Didn't you hear the reports? We're flat broke. They're turning out the lights.
Yeah, well, what I always love is the financial markets don't see it that way because, you know these people love markets so much. People are willing to lend money long-term to the U.S. government at, 2.7%, 2.8%. These are extremely low interest rates. So we're about to go under. Someone forgot to tell the folks on the financial markets that because otherwise they wouldn't be lending us money cheap.
Yeah, the CEO suites, they're doing quite well, thank you very much. And the folks on Wall Street. One of the things you wrote in an op-ed today that came across my desk that I wanted to ask you about. You said in the long term we can hope to replace the bubble-generated demand for the last decade because of the housing bubble with more net exports. This would come about through a lower-valued dollar that would make our goods more competitive internationally. How do you get to a lower dollar? And is it something that, because I remember during the Reagan years they had this high dollar policy because we're Americans and we have to have this high dollar. How do we get to a lower dollar value?
Well, it's actually very interesting because Reagan's a good model here. The latter part of the Reagan years, in 86, there was a deal negotiated between the United States, Germany, France, England, and Japan, the major at that time economic powers, China was a big deal at the time, where we agreed to act collectively to lower the value of the dollar. And they did this over about a year, year and a half period. The dollar lost about 20-30% of its value in, a very gradual process. There were no runs on the dollar. It was all handled very, very well, and it did what we wanted to. It brought the trade deficit way down. We had a trade deficit back in 86 that was over 3% of GDP. That would be about $500 billion a year in today's economy. By 1990, it was under 1%. That would be about $150 billion a year in today's economy. I mean, there are other things going on, but I don't want to say that was the whole story. But that was the bulk of it. And we could do the same sort of thing today. China's the big actor now, of course. And, it's a question of sitting down with China and negotiating it. I've heard the Treasury Secretary and others speak about this, and they go, well, China won't do it. And you go, well, you negotiate. I mean, you think China won't do it. I mean, we're China's obviously a big actor. We can't just, hit the table with our fist and go, oh, you can't do this. But you trade. What does China want? We work out deals. We do that all the time.
Yeah, they want access to our markets. I mean, and that's where I say, what do you mean they won't do it? Then they don't get access to our markets.
That's right. I mean, we have both carrots and sticks. It's just kind of common sense. The thing is, we're always asking for things from China. We have a whole list of things. We want Microsoft. Microsoft wants the better copyright protection for Windows. Pfizer and Merck patent protection for their drugs. Our financial industry, Goldman Sachs, wants to be able to open up more business, have more business in China. I mean, there's a whole list of things, which, understandably, we're going to have on our list. The thing that has to be clear with China is we go, okay, we got this list of, however many items, but number one is the currency. we need to have dollar fall against your currency. And that's front and center. You know, we'll talk about everything else, but that's got to be front and center. So the idea that if we really went there, we wouldn't be able to get them to do that, just absurd. Of course we'd get them to do it. We'd have to make concessions. You know, we'd have to give up other priorities, but we would do it if that was a priority.
Now, what do you think of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement? I've had people make arguments to me that this trade agreement's trying to put China in line. I'm curious of your thoughts.
Well, I don't know much. It's trying to put China in line. I think clearly it's about getting a lot of things that a lot of our corporations would very much like. I mean, one of the big things, we had a leak on this a few weeks ago. WikiLeaks published the chapter on intellectual property. So a lot of this is about serving our corporate interests. In the case of intellectual property, the drug companies in particular are trying to impose rules that will allow them to charge higher drug prices in our partner countries. Also copyrights, you know, the entertainment industry is hoping to get more money out of them for that. So it's kind of, you know, my view, sort of a corporate wish list. What would you like to impose on these other countries? And I should also say the United States, because you could write things into a trade agreement that will, of course, apply to the United States as well. You know, one of the issues that's come up is regulation of fracking. And if you write into the trade agreement that say state and local governments can't impose restrictions on fracking, well, then trade agreement. You know, Congress might never have voted to do that, or at least not directly, but if you have a trade agreement that's approved, well, that's binding. So that means the state of Pennsylvania or whoever it might be, they're not going to be able to restrict fracking. So I think it's kind of a chance for corporations to do an end run around basically democratically elected government.
And another way, and I understand the fast track vote is coming up here in the next couple of days or maybe just after the first of the year. And my thought was Merry Christmas on that. I want to go back to the budget here. Last question I've got for you. And is this going to pass, you think? Are they going to get it done before the Christmas break?
My guess is they probably will. I think that, you know, but I think at the end of the day, they'll say, you know, this is a better deal than just putting it off because, you know, as they're saying, it's a good deal for Washington. Well, they don't want to have another, you know, knockdown, drag out fight where they're up against the deadline again. So my bet is they're going to pass this.
Yeah, well, is what it is. Dean Baker, I appreciate the time. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and, you know, the reality is what it is. You know, they're going to get this passed through one way or another. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
A quote, message of the week is handed out. Talking points, including lines of attack, are distributed. Social media tactics are taught. New messaging tools like digital flyers are deployed. Opinion articles are pre-written, and a 17-page playbook lays out the strategy. All this and much more is part of an all-out centralized military-style assault that House Republicans are making in a desperate attempt to kill Obamacare, with their larger mission being to crush the idea that every American deserves good quality health care. The campaign is being directed through Speaker John Boehner's office, with all 231 GOP members expected to take marching orders, penetrate every media market, and stir up as much negative noise as possible to sabotage Obama's Affordable Care Act. Most members of this anti-care brigade, however, seem blissfully unaware of an explosive irony in their furious assault on Obamacare. It was their idea. While Democrats long advocated that universal health care should be achieved by simply extending Medicare to everyone, Republicans always countered that coverage should be run through the insurance corporations with a requirement that younger and healthier people buy into it. Richard Nixon proposed this concept in 1974. Then, in 1989, the Heritage Foundation, a Republican allied think tank, basically proposed the full privatized system embodied in the ACA, including the individual mandate that everyone buy an insurance policy. such far right-wing GOP Congress critters as Senator Orrin Hatch and Newt Gingrich became leading champions of this scheme, the very one that they and fellow Republicans are now trying to demonize and slay. This is Jim Hightower saying, the deeper irony is that should the GOP succeed, Democrats can then return to the more sensible plan of Medicaid for all. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Mr. President, do you see a major difference between the two of you on Social Security?
You know, I suspect that on Social Security we've got a somewhat similar position. Social Security is structurally sound. It's going to have to be tweaked the way it was by Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill. But it is, the basic structure is sound.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, going back over what Dean was saying there, and, you know, you look at this budget that, you know, Patty Murray, the Democrat, and Paul Ryan, the Republican, pretty much a lot of the Ryan budget in it, which is heavy on the austerity. Heavy on the, we're not going to extend unemployment benefits, we're not going to get a farm bill done. And I look at this, and you go back in U.S. history, and today, back in 1968, the Department of Labor announced that the nation's unemployment rate had dropped to 3.3%, the lowest mark in 15 years. And how'd they do it? Well, they did it with a lot of government spending. Got people to work in the private sector. A lot of public investment. And also a little bit of war. Also today, in 1995, 40,000 workers went on a general strike in London, Ontario. Now, London, Ontario at the time had about 300,000 people. So when you have 40,000 workers going on strike out of 300,000, that's a pretty sizable chunk. They were out protesting cuts in social services. And, you know, I got to be honest, I would love to see that many people out in the streets protesting the things that our governor's done, the thing that other governors have done in gutting social service spending and gutting food programs. I mean, really, at this time of the year, the fact that there's no farm bill, the fact that there may be in the new year hungry children in this country because they can't get their act together, the fact that you're going to kick these folks who have been unemployed for so long basically to the curb, at this time of the year, I guess should really anger us. Anyway, the farm bill. I guess yesterday the negotiators had come out, conceded the fact that they're not going to get it done. It's not going to happen before they go home for vacation. In fact, Debbie Stabenow, the senator from Michigan, said, "We're very confident that we're going to have an agreement. We will be ready to vote in January." It doesn't do much for the folks, at least in my confidence anyway. Anyway, the Congress and lawmakers are waiting for the final scoring from the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, related to the commodity title. According to reports, a central question is how much freedom can be given to farmers to reallocate crops within their base acres. That will become the index of allocating future assistance. Basically saying, you know, this is what we're paying for. Can they take the money and do something else? That's an interesting question. House Agricultural Chairman Frank Lucas Tuesday night said they filed a short-term extension of the current farm law to go through the end of January. But if the CBO numbers fall into place, he'd be happy to leave the extension on the shelf. Now, Stabenow said the Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack had assured the negotiators in a phone call that there was no reason for milk prices to spike if the farm bill can be put into place quickly in January. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, that one of the lines I saw is that they're about ready to take a plunge. Are we about to plunge off the milk cliff? Because we've gotten so accustomed to these hostage crises, to these ticking bombs down to the last minute kind of things. And I kind of hope Dean Baker's right. Maybe this could be the end of that mentality. Maybe, I don't know. But when I look at this, I go, you know, there's so much more we should be doing. And you go back and you go, 1968, a 3.3% unemployment rate. And people are happy with, you know, I saw a report say, happy days are here again. We're at 7% unemployment. I'm going, really, that's happy days? And maybe we are at 7% unemployment. But how many people are participating in the job market? How many people are have fallen out? And one of the things for me is, you know, you look at, and both parties are going to do this because of this budget. And you know, next year, if the unemployment extension doesn't happen, you're going to see about 2.5 million people fall off of the unemployment rolls, which obviously, because we calculate unemployment based solely on who's collecting. Not how many people lost their jobs, not how many people are out of work and looking. No, we base it on how many people are collecting and looking. So that's what the rate we come up with. So when you have, you know, 2.5 million people who are going to fall off of it, you got to then ask the question, does that lower the unemployment rate? And obviously the answer is yes. So will the demise and the pain and suffering of those folks, at those 2.5 million people, make for a good political talking point? And I know I've heard it before. Well, they should go out and get jobs. Well, I think study after study has shown that that's not quite as easy as you would believe. Now, me, I think, you know, I had a conversation with a friend who's like, you know, I really don't know what to do. And I said, well, why don't you start your own business? You know, say that you're for this time period, you've been employed doing your own thing. You know, and you know, try that angle. You were a consultant. Granted, you didn't get any work, but you were a consultant. And it just didn't work out, and now you're looking for another job. Now, I go back to my statement to Dean that I think we need to have a full employment policy, and we need to walk away from this austerity at all costs, and we need to use government as the employer of last resort, since that kind of is their job. When you have a lag in demand, a little boost will help. Because when you have a little lag, that little lag only gets a little worse, and then a little worse, and then a little worse. Until, because economies don't stagnate. They either spiral up or they spiral down. And I've argued that we've been spiraling down. The only reason that we haven't really seen the really draconian effects is we've had this, what's left of the tattered social safety net that's keeping it out of our eye. Now, yeah, you go back and you go, why'd we do away with unemployment offices? Well, so we didn't have to see those people. Why did we do away with the funny money cartoon welfare food stamps? Because we don't want to see people. And a private company could make a boatload of cash off of it. I mean, really, that's what it's about. They get all that servicing, because we love our public-private partnerships, don't we? Anyway, to me, this, I think Dean's spot on. Good for Congress, bad for us. Bad for the economy, bad for you, bad for me, but good for them. Takes it off the front page for a little while. And that seems pretty simple to me. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around and listen to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Trade representatives failed to reach an agreement in Singapore on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement as labor, environmental, and congressional critics blasted the TPP as an American jobs killer. United Steelworkers President Leo Girard.
Before you look at this deal, you got to look at all the previous deals and say which one of the trade deals that we've done has resulted in net job gains and net trade surplus for America. And you know what the answer is? None. We're
not against trade in the steelworkers union. We're against trade that continues to cost us jobs. The steelworkers union is aggressively opposed to the kind of trade deals we've been negotiating and would like to be part of a trade deal that actually created net jobs in America.
Teamsters President Jim Hoffa urges Congress to oppose the TPP and fast-track authority to pass it.
They've all been losers for America. American jobs are being basically exported. That's what's going on. Everybody knows it. And for people to put their heads in the sand and say, oh, trade agreements are good, they're not playing with the truth. They're not looking at what the facts are. And it's time for us to basically stand up. And the first fight is going to be over fast track. I urge members of Congress to stand up, say no fast track. We want transparency. And until you do that, it ain't going to happen.
Communications Workers of America President Larry Cohen says manufacturing is not the only major jobs hit that American workers are taking from these NAFTA-style trade agreements.
We've been losing service sector jobs at the same pace as manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years. As Leo said, we need to look at net results, net exports minus imports, and net results on jobs. The 600 multinationals that are promoting this, including many from the service sector, they're looking at their net profit. We need to look at net jobs.
U.S. Representative Louise Slaughter vehemently opposes both the TPP and Fast Track.
Fast Track authority is an undemocratic seizure of power that usurps our ability to represent the American people. I have never seen a single trade agreement that benefited American workers or American producers. And the flawed free trade agreements like NAFTA have destroyed American manufacturers and American jobs for more than 20 years, and we have to stop it from happening again.
Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Bruin shares the deep concerns of labor and some members of Congress over the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Sierra Club is deeply concerned about the effect of this PAC on working families in America, communities, our environment, and our climate. As trade expands, so does the potential for illegal trade and natural resources, such as trees and even wildlife parts, such as rhino horn or shark fin. To prevent these harmful practices, the Sierra Club and our 2.1 million members and supporters are calling for a strong and binding environment chapter of the TPP.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You got my list, right?
Yeah, go.
Cool.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Just got this really, really the exclusive email, an extremely confidential breaking news from the Laissez-Faire Club, who says Anthony Weiner, Elliott Spitzer, Arnold Schwarzenegger, it seems as if news of one another, more outrageous scandals break every day. But the president, President Obama, he's got a mistress. And then you go through this whole video where he had a steamy affair with a campaign staffer, and the good pastor James David Manning says his steamy love affair with Larry Sinclair, and it's a mistress that Michelle Obama knows. And you go through, you waste your time listening to the video, and his mistress, socialism. Jeez, oh man, I wasted 5 minutes of my life to get to that. Jeez, I don't know. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. and find out what's going on in the big town and around the globe. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. So what do you think, Justin? Obama's mistress? Socialism.
Well, socialism is an alluring mistress. God knows I fell for her when I was probably 15 or 16. But it's one of those things that once she breaks your heart and you realize it's never going to happen, you kind of learn to move on.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
And Michelle knows, and she secretly covers it up, and she supports it. Jeez.
That is an interesting hook. And at least it's a break from the usual kind of gay scandals that the Obama faced with.
Yeah. But the other thing is you read down in the really small print, brought to you by Agora Financial, because at the end of the whole thing, they're trying to tell you, no, because you know all this, it's socialism. Protect your money by investing and giving it to us.
There we go. You know, some people rely on sex appeal, and, they found a way to do it, so good for them.
Yeah, good for them. So, but the reason I bring this up, the whole socialism thing, because, the budget deal that they just came up with last night, I would not put that something Obama supports. I would not put that anywhere near the idea of socialism, considering no unemployment insurance. extension.
Exactly. This was something that a lot of Democrats were hoping was going to be added on at the last minute as sort of a bargaining tool. But instead, we saw Harry Reid coming out today and saying that he is not going to be supporting the extension of unemployment insurance until well after they expire. And that's going to be once Congress returns sometime in January before the January 20th end of the term. So it's a pretty bad news. What we're instead getting is something that seems to be falling far shorter than a lot of Democrats hoped for. It continues quite a few cuts with sequestration and whatnot. And it's certainly not anything that is stable or anything that's being really strongly embraced by both sides, other than those who are simply interested in, averting another government shutdown.
Yeah, and but I look at this and I go, okay, fine. You're going to bring it up when you come back from your vacation. Okay, what about those folks who, Merry Christmas, you're cut off. You've now figured out how you're going to make ends meet. And, oh, by the way, the economy as a whole, Merry Christmas, because even after the all of the demand from the Christmas holiday goes away, we're going to take this amount of money out of the economy as well.
No, that certainly is a very good point. And, when it comes to the short-term interest, especially with those involved in the long-term unemployment benefits, this is really coming at a bad time. And as Harry Reid said today on the Senate floor, rather, this is something that is strictly coming up because of Republican obstructionism, because they have been so adamant about trying to extend the nomination process for so many nominees. Of course, now that they have lost the power to filibuster, they are trying to sort of throw any kind of monkey wrench they can into the process, that he was sort of forced to see this. But, it certainly raises larger questions over what kind of fiscal policy we're going to be adopting, whether it's going to be anything that's worth supporting, and it certainly smacks of austerity in a lot of means.
Yeah, I spoke with Dean Baker a little bit earlier in the program, and he said, this was good for Congress. This wasn't good for you and me. Wasn't good for the country. It was good for them because now they're not going to have the fighting and the bickering for at least the next couple until 2015, I guess, which is how long this budget will go. So for them, this is good. It's going to give them maybe a point or two approval rating boost.
Well, good for them, but it also needs to still pass. We know, of course, that there are quite a few House Republicans who are not happy with this. They have accused Paul Ryan of selling out the conservative interests. And also on the Democratic side, we are similarly seeing in the House realm of things some reluctance on the part of some major House Democrats, such as Steny Hoyer today, who said, pretty rightly so, that this is something that falls quite short of what the public needs, and that he is not sure whether or not he is actually going to be supporting this. And he also added that Republicans are likely going to have to rally the votes for this themselves, which, of course, whenever we've seen that come onto, Boehner's plate, has never really never really worked out very well, though Boehner today is trying to be adamantly opposed to a lot of the third-party conservative networks who have really shot down a lot of these deals before.
Yeah, he's not Tom DeLay. He doesn't wrangle the votes.
No, he certainly does not. There's some serious questions over what the heck Kevin McCarthy is doing the current House majority whip, because he seems to have a pretty serious math problem when it comes to bringing things to the floor that really should be, at least on paper, shoo-ins for the GOP.
Yeah, so the question then becomes, does the Tea Party primary Paul Ryan?
Oh, God, if they do that, then they really are dead as a movement. Of course, any ideological movement needs to have at least, some sort of intellectual appeal. That's something that we've seen time and time again. And if they are really going to go after him, which I don't think I've really heard much about so far, then they really are going to be shooting themselves in the foot by robbing them of the one kind of claim of legitimacy that they do have.
Yeah. But in addition to the unemployment benefits going down, this is really an assault on the working poor of this country. When you don't extend the unemployment benefits, and they've already conceded, no farm bill this year, so that means no SNAP. That means, who knows what happens to food stamps in the coming year. And I saw an interesting little statement that we're about to go off the milk cliff, which I thought was interesting.
That's a pretty creative way of putting it, but it certainly does kind of raise what is a major problem. Of course, you mentioned SNAP beneficiaries, and it looks like the entire sort of legislative product that Congress has decided to take on in the remaining days of the 2014 the 2013 session really does end up affecting a lot of people individually where it really hurts the most.
Yeah, it's seeming to me that Congress is just turning, and I guess it's nothing new. It's just like the frat guys I went to college with. You know, basically the night before the exam, they're cramming everything and trying to get everything done because they've really done nothing but cause chaos for the last year. So here we are at the end of the road when really the rubber meets the road, and well, I guess we're gonna get run over, aren't we?
That's really what it looks like, and it's worth noting that there really is so much that has not been adopted yet, just beyond the farm bill, beyond a long-term budget, beyond sequestration. We, of course, have had quite a few false starts when it comes to immigration reform, which a lot of people across the country will tell you is one of the most necessary steps to take in order to achieve some kind of fiscal balance in this country. And we've continued to see a lot of very big policy issues when it comes to energy, when it comes to gun control to a lesser extent, really take a back seat. And that's just made more apparent now, and it really seems like nothing can be done.
Yeah, but Obama's got a mistress, don't you know?
Socialism. As long as we keep them apart, we're going to keep the family values together.
Yeah, see, because he wants an increase in the minimum wage, Justin, don't you know? Granted, his initial number was $9 an hour, but you got thousands of people out in the street saying 15, so he's come around to the 10-10 number. So, but socialism, Justin?
That's one of the best buzzwords, and, of course, Republicans have sort of changed the definition of that. Of course, if minimum wage now equates to socialism, we are dealing with a much different game than we have for quite some time, and that may have been probably the most disastrous impact of the Tea Party movement, just redefining something that has been not even really a safety net, just a basic recognition of the human worth that is now suddenly being cast as a dirty word.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if you work for a living, you put in your 40 hours a week, I'm sorry, you should not be anywhere near the poverty line. That just seems to me a basic principle. That should be the bottom line. If you punch the clock, you're working 40 hours, you're doing what we're told we should do. Work hard, play by the rules, you're going to get ahead. But, you look at the last several years, this president's almost no better than the last ones. We haven't seen that increase in the minimum wage of what, since about 7 years now? Yeah, 7 years.
That seems about right. And of course, it's worth noting that this is a development that really has an economic impact on the rest of the country. When these people can't afford to live, it's the taxpayer who ends up paying the burden of it who really ends up coming forward for the shortcomings of business.
Yeah, but that's the question I've been asking a bunch of people lately. Are we okay with this low-wage model? Because if we are, then we can't hold SNAP benefits hostage. We can't hold LIHEAP hostage. We can't hold all of these social safety net programs hostage and then demean and degrade the people who need them, because most of the people who get them are low-wage workers because we've allowed this system to exist, and we've subsidized it heavily.
That's certainly true. One would kind of argue at some point, sort of make a choice, get your priorities straight. Are you against, benefit programs? Are you against a safety net? Or are you in favor of actually giving people the tools to, sort of bring themselves up out of poverty and into the sacred middle class that politicians like to talk about so much?
Yeah. And finally, the president was in South Africa. There's the handshake, right? And now the interpreter. Or can we put gates to this, a handshake gate and an interpreter gate? Can we do that?
Well, if the right wing finds a way to slap this interpreter onto Obama, then they are, much more adept at this game than I would have thought. I have seen a few snarky Facebook comments saying, according to those who watched the interpreter, this speech made more sense than any speech Obama has given previously, which is sort of a dirty joke considering, how widely praised the speech was. This really was considered to be probably one of the finest of his presidencies. Presidency. And, so it certainly raises some questions. Talk Radio News has been looking into it. On our website, we believe we have identified who the person is. If you guys want to take a look at www.talkradionews.com, that, of course, was due to some pretty fancy footwork today from our Pentagon correspondent, William McDonald. And I just want to give us a little bit of a shout-out there because I'm a little proud of him.
As you deserve, as always. And, of course, what about Selfiegate, which I hate the word. I just hate this whole, you took a selfie. No, I took a picture of myself. They've been doing it for years. This is not new. You didn't reinvent the wheel. You're
just lonely and
pathetic, and you don't have a friend who's going to take a picture of you.
You know, I think it probably would have been much ruder if the man told the Prime Minister of Denmark he was not going to pose for a silly little Facebook photo, because that's probably more of an affront to common decency than snapping a selfie, especially when the photographer present noted that this was a very relaxed atmosphere. This was not a solemn moment. A lot of people were talking. And in a lot of ways, this seemed to be sort of like a, I don't want to say a joyous celebration since that sounds a little bit ghoulish, but this certainly was a sort of uniting moment for a lot of the world. This was, quite possibly the biggest funeral since Winston Churchill. Everybody seems to have acknowledged that Nelson Mandela certainly made a huge impact on the world, certainly made his imprint on the human spirit. And, it doesn't really necessarily seem fair to target Obama for being insensitive when he really has been such a powerful voice for, representing the U.S. at this difficult time.
Yeah, and for me, the rest of the a lot of societies around our globe, they do funerals a lot different than we do. They actually celebrate life instead of the black cloth and the crying and carrying on. I've been lectured about that a couple of times by friends who, when talking about funerals, they view it completely differently, being from other countries.
No, it's certainly true, and. We kind of have to distance ourselves from this and put it really in an international context and put it in the context of what was going on at the moment. And once you do, you really see that this was a huge non-story.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of them are anyway. Justin, always great to talk with you. Appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended from all things dark and cruel. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
A quote, message of the week is handed out. Talking points, including lines of attack, are distributed. Social media tactics are taught. New messaging tools like digital flyers are deployed. Opinion articles are pre-written, and a 17-page playbook lays out the strategy. All this and much more is part of an all-out centralized military-style assault that House Republicans are making in a desperate attempt to kill Obamacare, with their larger mission being to crush the idea that every American deserves good quality health care. The campaign is being directed through Speaker John Boehner's office, with all 231 GOP members expected to take marching orders, penetrate every media market, and stir up as much negative noise as possible to sabotage Obama's Affordable Care Act. Most members of this anti-care brigade, however, seem blissfully unaware of an explosive irony in their furious assault on Obamacare. It was their idea. While Democrats long advocated that universal health care should be achieved by simply extending Medicare to everyone, Republicans always countered that coverage should be run through the insurance corporations with a requirement that younger and healthier people buy into it. Richard Nixon proposed this concept in 1974. Then, in 1989, the Heritage Foundation, a Republican allied think tank, basically proposed the full privatized system embodied in the ACA, including the individual mandate that everyone buy an insurance policy. Such far right-wing GOP Congress critters as Senator Orrin Hatch and Newt Gingrich became leading champions of this scheme, the very one that they and fellow Republicans are now trying to demonize and slay. This is Jim Hightower saying, the deeper irony is that should the GOP succeed, Democrats can then return to the more sensible plan of Medicaid for all.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you.
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, you think about, just to kind of wrap this evening up, and what we've been talking about. You know, you look at all these subsidies, all the money that we give to corporate America, all of the sweeteners, if you will. Because, hey, if we give them money, they'll create jobs, right? Or that's what we've been repeatedly told time and time again, ad nauseum, that if we just give them lower taxes, lower wages, if we just give them the least restrictive trade barriers, they're going to create good jobs. And we hear that a lot. They're going to be a good job. And, you know, I've always asked the question, well, and I guess it's just my asking the next question. My wife always says that, you know, when she met me, she always asked the question. But one of the things she learned from me is asking the next question, the one where the detail comes in. And, you know, the good job. So what is a good job? Is it, you know, $8 an hour with no benefits? To some, maybe that is a good job. But I don't know that's something that you want to make an entire nation's economy based on. And, you know, I think of, you know, and I think we have this view. As a kid growing up, my grandfather always said, you know, if you grow up to be like me, you're just a truck driver, you'll be a failure. And I go, you know, I grew up and I learned to drive a truck and followed in that path and did fairly well for myself. Because of the union contract and the wages that I was paid because of that contract, I did really well. People today, not really starting out, not that fortunate. But, you know, he always said, you know, go get an office job, you know, become a professional. And I saw this report by Danielle Douglas over at the Washington Post that pointed out that, you know, because a lot of us think, you know, being a bank teller is a pretty decent job. You know, not bad. I mean, it's something you make a living at, right? Well, according to Danielle Douglas over at the Washington Post, almost a third of the country's 500,000 bank tellers rely on some form of public assistance to get by. Now, look, we gave in 2008, you remember the TARP money? We talked a lot about the $750 billion that we go, here, please, take it. Take it. No, just no strings. It's just two pieces of paper. No strings. Don't worry about it. Just take it. And you look at the analysis that Bloomberg News did back in May, that pointed out that the six largest banks in the country scooped up about $100 billion in additional subsidies since the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, went into place. So you're looking at $850 billion. Here, please, take it. A third of the country's bank tellers are relying on public assistance. According to the University of California at Berkeley's Labor Center, they point out that taxpayers are handing out somewhere in the neighborhood of $900 million each and every year to supplement the low wages that bank tellers are paid. And you look at this and you go, wow, this is, you know, multi-year, multi-billion dollar subsidies for these huge banks. Now, what the Labor Center there at UC Berkeley pointed out, that workers collected somewhere in the neighborhood of $105 million in food stamps, about $250 million through the Earned Income Tax Credit, and about $535 million in Medicaid and CHIP programs. Now, Obamacare should help some of that, take the half of that away by making sure that employers with 50 or more employees provide health insurance for their employees or pay a penalty. Now, the conservative response to that is, well, take away those programs and screw those workers. Understand, last thing I'll leave you with, the profits of our nation's banks topped $141 billion last year. $141 billion in profit. The average CEO, the average executive, took over $500,000. Think about that. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Appreciate you being here. Look forward to talking to you again tomorrow. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com.